Hello, good morning everybody. I hope you got more sleep than I did. You'll be pleased to hear your manager is taking this one badly. He woke up at 2:45 and didn't get back to sleep again. Thank you all for bearing with us, because I know it was last year was quite a choppy ride. But I'm pleased to see that a lot of the trends that we've seen come through this year really are trends that really started last year. And you know, remember that we've seen most markets peaked in March of last year, March, April. And since then, you know, they're nearly 20 to 30% down from there. So yes, we've seen it's been a lot of carnage in the first few days of January, but actually there was quite a lot of it was already kind of there. And so the portfolio hasn't really had to do a great deal in order to perform well. You've got on that page 2, you've just got the performance for the fourth quarter, which is kind of slightly again in these worlds, it's already the past, because you know, in the first probably up until now we're up kind of around about 14% in OEI and about 16% in OEI MAG. And indeed, you know, really the interesting question is, in lots of ways, some of the facts, what we've been forecasting is coming home to roost. So, and we're seeing it. So a lot of the actual facts which were debated before are kind of no longer being debated. And that's part and parcel of why the market's doing what it's doing. And the point is that, you know, one is very willing to be a micro investor when the conditions are benign and there are no problems and no bumps in the road. But actually, you know, what we can see is these markets are not going to go higher until some of the problems that we're talking about have been solved. Now, the old adage was that if a market has a problem, you buy the problem and sell the market, because the market can only go higher if the problem is solved. And if the problem is solved, you will make more money out of the problem, because that's where people have the greatest fear, than you will out of hiding away. Governments actually over the last 20 years have rather turned that on its head. Ever since Greenspan bought into the S&P in 1987 and then the Hong Kong Monetary Authority in 1998 successfully bought 10% of the Hong Kong blue chips, governments have seen fit to change the adage of if the market's got a problem, buy the problem, to if the market's got a problem, buy the market. And so actually what we've been seeing over the last 4 months is really on a larger screen, we've watched the Chinese authorities actually trying to buy everything. But their problem, and it's a problem for all of us, is that they don't just have one problem. They have got a bubble in housing, a bubble in lending, a bubble in the banking sector, a bubble in currency, a bubble in the stock market, and hidden unemployment. So really a bubble in employment. So, what one's got to keep remembering, and hey, look, the fact is lots of people accuse me of how do you know anything about China, Christian? And it is true. I went there once, hated it, and never want to go back there again. But the truth is that you can read between the lines on these things, and it's very, very obvious that what China is really about is the Communist Party in China. It's all about how do they stay in power. And that makes it a very difficult game, because you're not even looking, when you're looking at the economy, at is that going to recover? It's kind of how are the Chinese authorities, how is the Communist Party going to keep control of the situation as social unrest grows? Now, we know that at the peak of the stock market, when it was nearly 10 trillion, that, you know, the equity markets generally were, I think, were about 85 trillion. So it was kind of almost up to 12% of world markets were represented by the Chinese stock market. And, you know, what we can see is the 30 trillion of debt. And, you know, and that 30 trillion of debt represents something like 26% of all lending in the world, that lending being around about 110 trillion. Why is that important? Because it just means that China's now so integrated into the world trading system that what happens there is felt by us all. And the trouble is that the growth that Xi Jinping so enjoyed over the last 10 years was created by allowing wages to grow by 12%. That's why, you know, the bulls have always spent their life saying, hey, the service sector is growing at 10% or 11%. You know, that's what you should be looking at. The answer is, sorry, but if you're growing your wages at 12% and there is no, and it's unconnected to productivity, and you are, you know, you're basically, you are pegged to your major trading currency partner, namely the USA, and there the wages aren't growing as fast as that, then of course you're becoming increasingly uncompetitive. And the forces of deflation are felt through the whole system because you've got rising costs and you've got, and you're not able to pass them on. So the question is that, you know, where we are today is really, you know, can China afford not to devalue the renminbi? The answer is, you know, what we have watched over the last 4 months is they do something, it becomes increasingly painful, then they stop and they try and reverse it, but then they find that they've got to do more of it. So the answer is, you know, what we've just seen over the last 10 days, or 5 days anyway, is we've seen again them try, they've essentially blocked off foreign selling of renminbi. So, you know, now the question is with that, is that just because they don't want foreigners to make any money out of the devaluation of the renminbi? I would say that we probably got 3 or 4 weeks or, you know, maybe a little bit longer. But unfortunately, the forces of economics will prevail here. And the truth is, you know, China at some point is going to devalue in a big way. Why do I know that they're going to devalue in a big way? Because actually the world, what we're looking at the moment is a world full of overcapacity. We're coming on to the old later, but the fact is it's across the board. And at some point, this overcapacity has got to be shut down. And if you're the Chinese, you don't want to be the guys who are shutting that capacity down. You want everybody else to be shutting it down. You can't do that if you've got an overvalued exchange rate. You can do that if you've got an undervalued exchange rate. But if that happens, basically everybody else has got to be a victim. And if everyone else is going to be a victim, currency wars will lead to trade wars and can lead further than that. And it's important that because, you know, remember at the moment, what we are seeing in the markets is we're seeing anything connected with China, it has been very weak, but anything that is unconnected to China has continued along its merry way. Now, there are some good reasons for that, because obviously the oil price has been coming down, and therefore there's some good news on the consumer side for the West. But the trouble is, actually, it's partly in people not thinking actually how the knock-on effects of everything that we're talking about, i.e. the secondary effects will be increasing what we call autarky in economic terms. But let's go on to the fall, the oil price. The fall in the oil price has been good news for the consumer in the West. And we, you know, last year we saw a 34% increase in petrol demand in the United States, which was amazing. And basically everybody filled up their car. And then they bought another SUV and filled that up. So, well, America did react to that. But although the benefit hasn't been as great as expected, obviously in Europe and in lots of parts of the world, basically petrol has long, in many parts it was subsidized, and in many parts it was highly taxed. So highly taxed in the UK and highly subsidized in the emerging markets. So actually the effect of the falling oil price or falling petrol price hasn't been as great elsewhere as it has been in the US. And even there, what has been interesting, of course, is that you know, you haven't seen the pickup in demand, in consumer demand, in the same way that you did in 1998. And it would, you know, you can posit various different reasons for that, but the one that I feel is the most interesting is that since 2009, new employees coming into the wage force have not got the same very nice terms in terms of healthcare from their employers. They basically, they're kind of two levels now. And so, you know, given how fast healthcare costs have been rising, which is kind of 7 or 8% per annum since 2000, well, really throughout the last 2 decades, employees are really you know, basically building up their savings rate in order to kind of cope with what they fear are crippling healthcare costs. And it's also swayed by that fact that employees recently coming into the workforce are, you know, more the 45 to 65 and even through 65 than actually the 20 to 45. So it reflects the fact that a lot of people are coming back into the workforce because they got out thinking they had enough money, but of course with QE and the interest rates at nothing, they found out they run through their savings and they've got to come back. But the point is that not only have we not sort of seen quite the push through on the that we'd have expected in terms of consumer demand following on from the oil price climb, but also that the oil producers themselves have not actually cut back at all, and nor have they cut back on anything else. So what we've seen is those sovereign wealth funds, which kind of 70% of which were oil funds, basically experiencing large outflows. So that we've seen the Saudis, you know, withdraw $60 billion from bonds and equity investments, and we saw in December alone $37 billion flee Russia. And this sharp selling of assets into a relatively illiquid market has made these markets vulnerable to the downside. You know, that's, you know, what is astonishing is actually how little we've seen that felt in the markets, really, rather than how much. And it hasn't been helped by the fact that, you know, since the last quarter, individuals in the USA have become big sellers of equities and EM bonds and everything to do with that. So that it's kind of difficult to see. And what we've seen is share buybacks have been failing. They don't no longer outperform those companies that are buying back. In fact, they underperform because everyone says, where are you borrowing this money? So governments, let's go back to it. You know, governments can try and keep these markets up by buying, like the Chinese are. But the trouble is that when they're buying into the markets this time around, they're not buying cheap assets. You know, the Chinese are buying shares on 4x book value. Stock markets are globally on P's of nearly 20 times, and bonds have never been more expensive. So, you know, it's a dangerous time for governments to be basically deciding that this is the level they want to be at. And it's been no wonder, therefore, that we've read, you know, George Osborne visibly warning that a cocktail of dangers and headwinds are coming our way in the UK, and that we appear to be facing it only armed with a sense of entitlement and a lack of financial discipline. And they're not great weapons of war, those two, actually. And why is it important? Because, in a way, George is alluding to something which I think is the second strand in why the markets are as uncertain as they are today. And that is that, you know, it goes back to 2008. And when they lowered interest rates from 5 to 0, all central banks were worried that this was going to encourage ill discipline in the borrowing and in the lending, and which could be dangerous and speculative. But, you know, they were quietly happy that the near-death experience for many borrowers in 2008 kept them disciplined in their borrowing and their behavior, even as the world recovered. But, however, since 2012, and there's quite a good chart in this one, you know, they were page sort of 13, so I haven't really kept very close to this one, but page 15 is the one as well here. But since 2012, there's just been growing examples of dangerous behavior as far as the central bankers are concerned. In banking, there is an incipient bad behavior in the form of what we in Europe call syndicated lending, and in the States they call leveraged loans. You know, this is basically lending in which a lending bank, let's give an example, you know, goes to an entrepreneur, he's usually a property entrepreneur, and they say, look, we will give you £200 million, you don't have to put any equity up, we need your expertise, and but you know, so we'll give you that, and it's non-recourse. because that's because the entrepreneur is not a fool. And so, but the only nice thing for the bank lending this money is that they get a 5% commission for lending this money. As soon as they've lent the money, or even as they're lending the money, they syndicate it off to another 9 different banks, so that by the end of that month, they've got in a 5% commission, and their actual loan lending has only increased by 10%. So in fact, they're making a kind of 50% return on that loan. All looks marvellous, except that if you play by this game, then your friends come round very quickly and they say, we've got something very similar, and you this time have got to basically take your 20 million and no commission payable. So, and you know, this has been going on. You can sort of see these leverage loans. They creep up and they creep down, but they love to creep up because it looks so sweet. It's so nice. It's commissions for bankers. That's what we like to see. But, of course, the trouble is that they never work out quite so sweetly as they work in. And typically the loss when the music stops is at least 50%. And typically you lose much more money than you ever made on the commissions. But who cares? They're a different lot of people. That type of lending, as you can see, actually, you know, they've been trying to attack it. You know, they bring it down, and it's peaked in kind of 13, 14, and is a little bit lower than it is now, but it's dangerous. And the second bit of lending, which they now see as being pretty frightening, is, of course, the unsecured lending, which in the UK is growing at 9% and the US is growing at 12%. Most of that is basically in car finance. And again, it just, you know, today's number, the UK, that the financial indebtedness of the average person is now 149% of their income. That's up from about 120 in 2008. So we, you know, suddenly, after 7 years, basically what we are seeing is we are seeing ill discipline coming through in the developed world. And what have central banks done to kind of try and address this? They've introduced what they call macroprudential measures. And macroprudential measures do remind one of the early 70s and corsets and all these things, which you basically, where you introduce effectively higher interest rates in those areas of lending that you do not want to encourage. And most central banks have been involved in macroprudential lending in the last couple of years. But the Fed has a problem in this regard, and this is the important point. And the problem that they have, as we know, is bank lending is only 40% of credit in the US. So actually, if they indulge in macroprudential lending, all they do is they corner the banking sector and they make it more difficult for them to lend, but they don't basically corner the other 60%. So macroprudential measures don't really work in the US. And it means that if you are faced with ill discipline, the only way you can cure that is to put up interest rates. And that's why since 2012, there's been a growing body of the Fed who have a very different view to the one that we have been used to since Greenspan and Bernanke have always seen that basically markets are what you should be supporting. These guys start from a position whereby they say, actually, we need to raise interest rates as much for macroprudential reasons as for whether, in fact, there's any inflation out there. And their thinking is essentially they have on top of that, they have the view that if only the world could start to move into a world of where price rises led to wage rises, led to price rises, led to interest rate rises, which themselves were a cost, and that led to further price rises, which led to wages. You end up with a world of the 70s, not a world of the 90s, but certainly not a world that we've known for the last 20 years, but one in which ultimately, although interest rates are going up nominally in that environment, actually in real terms, interest rates are falling, but indebtedness, and that's the important thing, for the individual is actually falling in real terms, and certainly not growing. And the point is that what we have here is we have Fisher and Bullard, and we have a few others, who are basically, they're of the view that interest rates have got to go up by at least 1%, i.e. four increases of 25 basis points. Now, and in there, I think, they have to be aware that this may be the wrong time to be raising interest rates, and that it may engender a recession in the United States in the next 9 months, because there are a number of leading indicators which highlight that is growing. You know, so what we, but I think their feeling amongst that lot is actually, you know, a recession now is one that we can handle. It's not necessarily good politically, but it's one that we can handle because the banks are in so much better position than they were in 2009. And on top of that, their view is that maybe a fall in the stock markets, because obviously part of this is that they are very aware that the stock market has at the moment, or all markets are of the view that there will only be at most two raises of interest rates. So that it's only a 0.5, not a 1% increase in interest rate costs over the next 12 months. So they have to be aware that the stock market may take this badly. But their view is that the wealth effect of the lower oil price will offset basically the wealth effect of falling equity markets. And that it's, and from their point of view, it's, you know, you are re-establishing a cost of capital. You're doing all the things that you really want to do. You don't want to be beholden to what is going on in China, because you can't tell what they're going to do there. What you've got to do is you've got to make sure that your own economy basically is working properly. And that, you know, for these people, there is really a sense that the lack of creative destruction has been a great weakness over the last 6 or 7 years. And it's something that I fully share with them. Now, the question is still, is, you know, are they, you know, yes, there's Bullard, yes, there are a few others, Johnny Fisher. Remember, Fisher was, you know, ran central bank in Israel. So he's kind of he's a natural leader of all these things. But you know, has he got Yellen and Dudley? I don't think he has. I think they are still doves. But, you know, what we saw in that December move was that they are kind of, they are biddable, partly because they're fascinated by actually how do you control that unruly mob, the 60%, which is not basically controllable by our Fed funds rate. So, you know, what we saw on the 18th of December was, you know, Yellen was really more interested to see, can one ever really raise interest rates in this economy, you know, just by introducing reverse repos, etc. So maybe he's going to sort of, you know, get her interested in the keep her under the bonnet whilst these things are going on. I don't know. All I feel is that, you know, for the first time in, you know, in 20 years, there is a sense in which that the central banks are not looking at the stock market to see whether in fact the economy is healthy. They are looking to the economy, and you read it every day, and they're feeling it. And the truth is that there is enough in the US economy to say it's going to be strong enough anyway for the next 3 to 5 months, irrespective of what is happening in the rest of the world, for them to continue to pursue this. So now, I think it also, what I find that is interesting there is that it rhymes with suddenly Osborne coming out with this much more aggressive prophecy last week, in which he was again saying, hey, look, people should be prepared for higher interest rates. And, you know, there was just too much complacency. Meanwhile, and these are the charts that kind of follow on from, you know, 16 onwards, you know, what is true? And again, it's part of the reason why the stock markets are continue to be so weak, is that credit conditions continue to deteriorate. You can see this in that, you know, we are seeing high yield bonds are continuing to sell off. We're seeing on the next chart that you can see corporate bond spreads. You know, we saw last night ABI basically 10-year 3.47. They were hoping for 2.6. You know, the cost of capital is going up for business even as we speak. And then you can see tightening, you know, the senior loan officers tightening conditions. And the answer is, with all of these, is really, it's what we have talked about before, which is that this is kind of unconnected to whether interest rates are going up. They're really going up outside of the non-administered rates anyway. So again, let's, you know, on top of this, all of this just says the world is becoming a bit more dangerous, and I would argue that the problem is that there is no easy equilibrium, that the equilibrium that we've had, which has allowed us to you know, have gently ascending markets since 2009, really, the fact is we can't get that equilibrium until we have sorted out some of these problems. And actually, we missed out on the oil a bit. Sorry about this one, but did we? I don't think we really talked about, you know, because again, with oil, I mean, we have made quite a lot of money this year out of the fact that with some puts on the near end of the oil market, which again has really just been to say, you know, here is another example of nobody willing to cut production, you know, that with zero interest rates, it's sort of being left to markets in the end to so drive down prices that you actually end up getting rid of surplus capacity. And here we are today now with, you know, the fact is we have been overproducing by pretty well 2 million barrels a day since June of 2014. And so we've got well over a billion barrels of excess production, and which is now in storage in anywhere. And you can see that inventories are at all-time highs across the board. And, you know, the question here really is, you know, how much more storage have we got? And because, yes, there's signs that the US 500,000 barrels are not being produced at the moment. But the answer is that still is 1.5 million. And when you look at where Saudi are, and you know, this is a fight to the death really with the Iranians, etc. So they are not going to cut production. So the question is, at some point, the price of oil almost has to go to zero. It has to go to a level at which people say this is ridiculous. And that's why, you know, what we've seen in the last 3 months is in 3 months the oil price has gone from 45 to 30. But you know, the trouble is, you know, even at 30, the excess inventories that are building just mean the scope for any kind of rally is non-existent. And so it's a sort of one-way game. And my point about that is, you know, remember a year ago, kind of everyone was very optimistic that oil price decline was just a net positive. Whereas, again, for me, it sort of relates to the surplus, the excess capacities. It relates to this, the risks that we have for this year, which is that we will see following on from the next. From the behavior of the Chinese, etc., we will see the beginnings of real currency wars, trade wars, and really much more reduced activity than we've been expecting. And that is when the rest of the world will basically also have to adjust. But the point is here is all of this is happening now at a time when the market is itself quite weak. And quite fragile, and some of that is really to do with now, It's to do with valuation as well as everything else. But it's primarily now. My cry was always, you know, August gave us a wonderful lead indicator that life was changing, because the low made on the 21st of August was lower than the low for the Dow in September of the previous year. It was the first time since 2009 in which we'd reversed the trend. So, you know, the expectation for me after August was, irrespective of a rally, the markets were going to go lower rather than higher. Now, you know, today, you know, one of the important bits is look in on that August low. The level of pessimism was amazingly intense. Only 16% of all stocks were above their 150-day moving average. Today, where we are, we're kind of at around about 30% or 27%. So it's, the answer is we're not at those lows that we were at, even though we're at the actual lows. So, which is, again, very much as you'd anticipate, that this is a market which actually, one, it couldn't have sprung the surprise and the ambush at a better time, because most people didn't roll their bear positions on the 18th of December because they were waiting for Santa's little rally. And it meant that they certainly didn't have those in position when the market started to go wrong on the first day of January. And what you're now, and the answer is it has been almost impossible to get into those positions since then. And what we are seeing at the moment is we're seeing a running correction, which is, again, a very, very weak, it's a weak market, because what you're seeing is anything that is not really connected with China has had quite a nice bounce since Friday of last week. And it's sort of now kind of back to the top of that trading range. But then yesterday was the beginning of that breakdown of the sort of Nifty 50, the FANGs, et cetera, who'd bounced through, and then suddenly they were selling off. Now, the answer is I fully, you know, like anything, these are trading markets now. And the fact is, this is what we do. We didn't always do this, but it's what we do. You know, we will be very happy to buy back when everything tells us, you know, we're oversold, because you know, we didn't in times past, and that actually we can do it. We've got the liquidity. That's good news. We're small enough actually here. So, but it, you know, so the interesting bit is, you know, are we going to be able to make quite a lot of money out of this bear market? Well, the nice thing is we've done a lot of work on it. You know, the fact that it's taken so long to happen has also meant that, you know, we have a lot of thinking that's gone on. And that, you know, one of the nice things, again, you know, last year, although emerging markets never really recovered, the fact was that any stock inside emerging markets that wasn't involved in extractive industries or the oil, it actually re-rated upwards, because there's still... Actually, under, you know, you lot are all still out there secretly believing that emerging markets grow at 6% and demand grows at 8%, and that's what you believe in. Well, the answer is, you know, as a result of that, you know, you stick anything that's a kind of consumer related in the emerging markets on around about 23 times earnings, which is kind of no difference to their counterparts in the developed world. And it means that actually in certain instances where, in fact, you know, life is definitely getting tougher, you know, that makes them very vulnerable, these ones. And they've had, a lot of those had a 50% rise last year, and, you know, they've got a long way to go down. So what, and on top of that, there is this problem again, which is, you know, we are probably at that point in which it's not only central bankers who are looking at this, but everybody wants wages to be rising. And when in an environment in which wages are rising, profits are falling. You know, we see it here in the UK, where essentially George Osborne is so intent on allowing, you know, making sure that the minimum wage goes up, really, to meet the living wage. The living wage is nearly 11 quid, and the minimum wage was 6.70. You know, the answer is, in that environment, the cost all basically falls on the private sector. And I'm afraid, given that the living wage is already being paid by governments to individuals, actually there's no increase in demand for the, as an offset. So all of this, you know, it makes me very scared to be very long. And you know, on the long side, we have been, you know, around about 40% in cash since the second half of this year. We put a bit of to work. There are some areas of the market that are looking a little bit stronger. We're seeing proper kind of price increases coming through in the telecom sector in Europe. You know, it's long overdue. We saw it in the UK happen about 3 years ago, but we haven't seen it in Europe. And we've seen very strong price increases in America for the last 10 years, and that's been associated with quite strong capex and everything else. So there are certain sectors which I'm more optimistic than I have been. I remain reasonably pessimistic about banks. Again, you know, my problem with the banking sector is, as I say, it hasn't been used for any of this recovery. The problem is if we are now going to move in. I mean, when I look at what are we doing here, we are essentially, you know, starting to say, you know, we're looking at debt structures of companies because we see that there will be, you know, the next thing that we will be doing probably at the end of this year is we'll be buying debt in companies that we like the look of, and you know, because we think that this is going to be, we're finally going to get that denouement, that recession. Now, if you're getting a recession, you know, your non-performing loans in America will rise much sharper than you basically than any kind of net interest margin improvement. So I can't get optimistic about any of that. And you know, we've had, China, we're on China QE. Someone's asked a question, what about the risk of China QE? The answer is, what else have we had but China QE? I mean, you know, they've tried to close down every market that basically doesn't agree with them. And unfortunately, they've just got too many problems. You know, as I keep on saying, just imagine, you know, the problem that they have is they need wages to grow by 10% for unrest not to increase. They need it to grow by 10% because the housing basically demands that people's wages be 50% higher in 5 years' time. But they also now need a devaluation because... And the answer is, if they were to get a QE, proper QE, I think they would even more need the devaluation because they would have to recapitalize the banking sector, which is, you know, is wildly under recapitalized. Now, one of the positions we have on, which I just think is a slam dunk and is a free option, is a put on the Hong Kong dollar against the US dollar. Again, it's, you know, everybody's sort of the view that Hong Kong will behave in much the same way as it did in 1998, but the situation was entirely different in 1998. In 1998, the loan deposit ratio of the Hong Kong banks was about 30%. Their loans only represented 30% of their deposits. If you looked at those loans, they were collateralized always against basically assets where the creditors could get possession. So it was in the first world that they would be collateralized against. They were all in either in Hong Kong dollars or in dollars. So in fact, there was no mismatch on the currency either. Whereas this time round, you know, thanks to 2 years ago, 55% of Hong Kong banks' loans are in mainland China in renminbi. So whatever starts to happen to the renminbi starts to basically undermine Hong Kong's position. And in some ways, Hong Kong, here it was, a unique financial center, very useful if you were basically trying to open up and try and sort of understand the rest of the world and trade with them on the same basis. In a world in which you're kind of closing down anything that looks like capitalism, you know, Hong Kong looks a very strange thing to have on your doorstep. My own view about the whole thing is, secretly, if the Hong Kong banks were to have a bad time and needed recapitalizing, and the Chinese government said, we would like to step in and we'll recapitalize you, you know, put 35% more in, but we'll own it now. I think that's very, you know, that's the kind of picking that, you know, that the Chinese government would love to have, you know, because everything else looks really difficult for them. That's my point. My point is they've got such conflicts of interest. But, you know, so the interesting bit here, I want to end, but is I think there's, you know, this market, all markets, you know, bear markets have more up days than down days. You know, we haven't seen many of those for a while now. But the answer is we will get some of those, and there is a sense in which we may get some stability for the next 3 or 4 weeks. But how long does that go? You know, my point is, you know, governments, back to this point that, you know, the adage was when the market's got a problem, you buy the problem, you sell the market. The truth is you don't. You only buy the problem when it's solved, when you can see how it can be solved as well. Now, that's why, for me at the moment, I can't see how you solve the problem of China without China deciding that it wants to undermine the rest of the world and its own trading system that's been built up over 20 years, where, you know, they represent 13% of world trade. Because I, you know, and if you are clever than I am and can work out how they can do that, then please tell me, because, you know, then you have got a chance that this stock market will go up again and hit new highs. But my problem is that, you know, we are already, you know, 7 years old, the stock market. It's not that age isn't a condition, but the problem with age often is there's quite a lot of bessel that gets involved in the whole thing. I mean, one of the things that we find is, you know, a lot of companies that you think have no leverage at all have secretly basically got offtake agreements with other guys which really just means they've got future losses which they should be at least showing to the market but aren't. So we, you know, there are just some bad things happening. Anyway, my sensation is that, as I say, is you look at the market, you know, we will have a bounce, but if I was you, I would continue to worry. Because if I go, you know, historically, bear markets take out the last 5 years' gains. Now, that's not, you know, that's a easy sweeping statement, but it kind of, you know, we start this bear market with equities very highly valued because bonds were so highly valued. And, you know, if in a world in which earnings then start to misbehave, and they've already started to misbehave, remember, oil stocks are going to have a 70% drop in earnings in the fourth quarter. You know, earnings themselves become questionable, and that means, you know, you want to be buying with a fair degree of of fat. And the fact is, again, it goes back to why is it the Amazons of this world have been such great outperformers? It's really because there's you're mad to be buying in to some of these failing sectors in advance of seeing that capacity withdrawn. You don't know what you're buying. And I think you're probably buying the wrong thing because you're buying the equity. And I think it's not going to be resolved through the equity. It's going to be resolved through the debt because these things are going to have to go bankrupt. And so in much the same way, my cry is for the market is I still think that once we set off on this path, you know, in a year's time, we should be 20 to 30% lower than we were at the start of the year. I mean, you know, we should see, and once we see that capacity out, once we can start to basically invest again in a world which will be perceived to have much greater risks than we've ever seen before, that'll give us some opportunities. And I think once we have those opportunities, you know, that's the moment when you're going to be less inclined to buy something on 300 times earnings if you can really see that you could make 2 or 3 times your money. But remember, you know, in all of this, you know, those people who hope that the government's going to bail them out and this is just a bump in the road, I say to you, you know, I wouldn't put my trust in princes. I think you have got to expect that basically they may let you down. They may choose to change their priorities, and that's a little bit what the Fed is, I think, starting to do. I think on top of that, I just think, you know, history suggests that we do not have long periods of time in which the stock market grows by 12% per annum for 5 years and carries on. The truth is, over 100 years, it's been difficult to get the stock market to grow by more than 2.5%. And why does that happen? It's because you have lovely periods when the stock market grows very fast, and then it falls by 40%, and then it starts again to grow by 12 to 15%. Now, if you can avoid those falls, you can basically, that's when the secret to a compounding return. Anyway, thank you very much indeed for listening. Many thanks.